From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for Los Angeles Times, and Michael Williams, CBS News radio contributor. And here are the issues. North Korea. A lot to report on that, including comments from President Trump and a rebuttal from the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has been in Southeast Asia. What might have been missing from his discussions there? Venezuela continues with political turmoil. And finally, here in the US, a public feud between Republican leaders in Congress and the Trump administration. So, it's been an extraordinary week in terms of America's relations with North Korea. But before we get into the sort of the war of words between the American president and the North Korean leader, let's just set the stage for why every American president in recent history has found this a problem with no good solution. So, Michael, why doesn't America, which has all this sort of firepower, just take out North Korea or launch a strike or show them what's what? Why is this such a complicated problem?
Well, the complication is because of the nature of the Korean Peninsula itself. It's very densely populated. North Korea and South Korea are very, very close together. There really is no practical way to go in and launch an attack on North Korea without getting an immediate retaliation on South Korea. And with Seoul literally just minutes away, you're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of casualties in a relatively short period of time. So excessive shows of force, or even minimal shows of force, are really sort of a last resort type of situation when dealing with this problem. The idea of building up a nuclear arsenal, I believe, with North Korea is to prevent regime change. I don't think that they want war. I don't think that anyone on that peninsula or anywhere in Asia really wants armed conflict. What North Korea seems to be wanting, and most experts agree in this analysis, is to deal with the U.S. on an equal footing as a member of the nuclear club. And once they have that nuclear capability in place, that precludes regime change, which is most important to Kim. He is trying to solidify his base, solidify his position, and his nuclear buildup is really a strategy for that particular outcome.
So, Tracy, for our listeners who are not here in Washington, they may remember, you know, moments like the buildup to the Iraq War in 2003, where you had quite a lot of politicians in Congress who really did think that the best thing to do was to launch a war and to take out Saddam Hussein. Are we in that moment again? Should people overseas worry that there is a big kind of war party pushing for war, trying to find excuses for war in North Korea? Or actually, is this time a bit different?
Yes, I do think it's a different moment. I think that, as Michael pointed out, attacking North Korea would have disastrous consequences immediately. Millions of casualties in the Korean Peninsula, Japan, there are a lot of Americans as well, American troops. So I think even the most hawkish American officials do not want a war. And I think Kim also is not suicidal. I don't think he wants a war either. I think Michael's right in saying what he most cares about is survival, protecting his regime. And when someone like Secretary of State Tillerson says, we are not after regime change, I think that's consoling words. Unfortunately, it's undercut by Trump's threats. But right now, we have not seen any significant U.S. military movement that would suggest there is really a war about to break out. We hear a lot of words, a lot of threats, and we know that North Korea has been building its arsenal. But I don't think we're at that moment of imminent war. You know, Iraq was a different situation. You could attack Iraq and not have the kinds of disastrous consequences, although, you know, that turned out differently. But I don't think we are at that moment of imminent war.
So why, Michael, is there this sense of urgency? I mean, after all, President Bill Clinton signed a deal to try and stop North Korea advancing its nuclear weapons in 1994. George W. Bush did the same in 2005. Essentially, the plan was to bribe them. Tons of food aid were delivered. A lot of money was sent over. And the problem was that they then turned around and cheated and kept going with the nuclear weapons. So we're used to the idea that you have this very isolated, very repressive, very strange regime, really not like any other on Earth. Why are people so worried now? What's changed in terms of their arsenal? What are they testing and developing that has got Washington so jumpy?
Well, the news about sort of the capability and where the technology is troublesome and worrying to hear a first strike could reach blank. And
so you're within that. The key is these envelope. ICBMs.
The ICBMs, the miniaturization of the weapons and the ability to carry these nuclear weapons to places that they haven't been able to carry them before.
So there's one thing to have a set of bombs inside a kind of mountain.
Right.
Once you have a ballistic missile that could theoretically hit United States.
The Western United States, because they've had the ability to put it on an artillery shell for decades, as you said, or a decade, let's say. The other thing that sort of ratchets up the temperature on this is the nature of the two leaders. And I find it interesting that a French publication had a picture of the North Korean leader with Trump's hair, and your own publication had a picture with the two leaders emanating from the same mushroom cloud. The implication is that they are very much of the same personality, and I think neither one really understands the difference between negotiation and diplomacy, and there is a very, very important difference between those two. In a way, the way they negotiate is solidifying their positions with their relative, with their respective bases in a way that you would almost think that they had planned it between the two of them.
I mean, there's many moral differences. We shouldn't try and say that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un are the same, you know, moral equivalent.
I do not.
Kim Jong-un is one of the world's most wicked dictators, and I know that's not what you're saying. But there's another kind of tactical difference, which is North Korea basically has one card. It's sitting at the table with one card, but it's an ace, and it just knows how to play that ace again and again. But it basically has nothing else. I mean, the North Korean economy is 1/50th the size of the South Korean economy. Its people are starving. The American president has a huge range of options and a huge range of allies and the United Nations. So, Tracy, I wanted to ask you, before we get into this kind of latest war of clashing words that we've seen towards the end of the week began in the United Nations Security Council with what looked like a bit of a win for conventional diplomacy and actually some pretty skilled American diplomacy, achieving a resolution that is quite hard to pull off. What did they pull off with that vote?
Yes, Security Council voted unanimously to impose new sanctions, another round of sanctions on North Korea that would basically cut their income by a third. $1 billion of potential export income would be cut because of restrictions put on their exports. And Russia and China voted along with the United States. So yes, it could be cited as a victory of conventional diplomacy and potentially very punishing of North Korea. But then that kind of diplomacy is undercut when, you know, Trump begins his war of words. China previously had gone along with sanctions against North Korea under the Obama administration, 2016, last year. But what we saw was that China didn't necessarily enforce those sanctions from 2016. They continued to trade pretty robustly with North Korea. So the hope of this administration here in the United States now is that China will be more on board and will participate in actually enforcing the sanctions. But, you know, then China sees these kinds of threats coming out of Washington, coming out of Trump, and you have to wonder if China is as willing to cooperate when it sees that kind of rhetoric. So I think, in a sense, Trump is, you know, undercutting his own hand.
And, of course, the problem with China and the sanctions is that in the hierarchy of horrors seen from Beijing, a nuclear North Korea is number one for the Americans. But for the Chinese, it's number two. And the number one in their hierarchy of horror is a collapse of North Korea and a hostile, destabilized North Korean regime and chaos in Korea and refugees coming across the border.
Yes, refugees.
So the effect of that, you know, I used to be based in Beijing, you would talk to people who would say the effect of that is that the Chinese will impose any level of sanctions except those that might actually work.
Right.
Because they don't want the collapse of the North Koreans. So, Michael, let's talk about... So we had this vote in the United Nations Security Council. As Tracy said, it's unanimous. So the Chinese sign on for these tough, painful sanctions. But there were other elements of American diplomacy that looked pretty normal and conventional this week, too. We had the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. We had James Mattis, the Defense Secretary. We had other big voices in Congress who watch foreign policy. They've all been sounding relatively normal, relatively conventional, kind of, you know, let's keep this calm, let's keep this about diplomacy. What have they been saying before we get to President Trump?
The diplomatic efforts by Tillerson, I think, have been impressive. I think the language has been very steady, very stable on his tour of Asia, the three countries that he visited. I think he showed a lot of restraint and a lot of practicality.
And on North Korea, he was asked on the plane as he was flying back from this trip, actually about to refuel in the island of Guam.
Yeah.
He was asked, should Americans feel that there's about to be a war? And what was his response to that?
His response to that, all is calm, essentially. All is calm. And I think that the real difference is, and you have to go back to President Trump's words, that the difference between the level of tension that we would normally feel in this situation is the rhetoric of the U.S. leader. We've never had a U.S. leader that's had this type of response to the typical sea of fire North Korean rhetoric. We've had that for a year, my entire life. We've had that. But now you have a president that responds in kind, and that sort of undercuts those diplomatic motions by Tillerson and others.
We'll have a mid-break, and then we'll come back straight into the really important question of what President Trump has been saying and how that fits in with the rest of the administration. So first, a reminder that you are listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, with The Economist. Joining me today are Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times and Michael Williams of CBS Radio. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it, and then tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. So, Tracy, you were about to say something I think very important about the relationship between Rex Tillerson, big, big boss of an oil company, brought in to be the Secretary of State to run American foreign policy, although he is not a diplomat by background. He's been saying these quite calming, soothing things, actually literally said Americans should sleep well tonight, there isn't going to be a war. But then there's a contrast with the man he serves, President Trump.
Right. I was going to say that Tillerson rarely speaks on the plane. So the fact that he did this time was he was very deliberately sending a message that calmed down. But then you have his boss, who undercuts him repeatedly in public on many issues, this being the latest, coming out and threatening locked and loaded, I think was one of the...
Said all the military options are locked and loaded.
Locked and loaded. And
fire and fury.
Fire and fury, essentially threatening war. And then one of Trump's spokespeople, Sebastian Gorka, came out and said, well, it's nonsensical to listen to Tillerson, which was really quite an insult, quite a slap. And the State Department has pushed back at that, saying, in fact, you know, Tillerson does have a role here. So there's this, I don't know how much of this is the infighting at the White House and how much of it is deliberate good cop, bad cop. It's hard to know that there is a well-thought-out strategy in this White House.
So, Michael, tell us about the reporting that we're seeing coming out of places like the White House. One explanation could be that Donald Trump and his advisors have worked out an incredibly brilliant, calibrated strategy where he says very tough things to get the North Koreans' attention and to break a diplomatic deadlock that has been going on for too long. And then Rex Tillerson says less dramatic things, and there's a kind of good cop, bad cop. That's one explanation, the optimistic explanation. There is then another explanation that actually he was just making it up as he went along. When you look at the reporting coming out of the White House, are most people siding with the optimists or with the pessimists?
Well, the former, the brilliant strategy premise, only works if you're also willing to agree that part of the strategy is that somebody went to Rex Tillerson and said, you have to look totally uninformed and silly as a part of this strategy. Now, if he agreed to that, then yeah, okay, I'm going to buy into the first. So I have to go with the latter. And that's, again, where the danger in this whole situation really comes in. The uncoordinated nature of this administration that has been the bugbear of its operations throughout legislative policy, foreign policy, any policy you can possibly name. When you have people, again, who don't know the difference between negotiation and diplomacy, it's a very, very stark thing. And when the president starts talking about we are going to respond to a threat, again, that's a diplomacy thing. Diplomacy is about specificity and clarity of language. What is a threat? And when does that threat create our desire to pull a trigger on something?
And that first very bombastic statement that kind of kicked off this latest sense of drama, where President Trump said that he would, you know, that North Korea would face fire and fury like the world has never seen. We've actually seen reporting, haven't we, that his advisors, did they know that was coming? Were they expecting that? Was that scripted?
There are some who will say nod and say, yes, they did know. And there are others who, when asked off the record, would say we had no idea completely. And I think both maybe would be telling the truth. I mean, he may have uttered that phrase somewhere in a lunch or on the golf course and received a lot of nods and thought that guy, okay, that's got positives from the test group. Let me use that in front of a microphone. I can absolutely see that happening.
He's used that phrase, like the world has never seen before, to describe many things mm-hmm. for the last couple of years, a grassroots movement, the likes of which the world has never seen. So it is something he's used. It's one of his stock lines.
That's a really important point, isn't it? Because people are used to thinking that the American president has weighed every word carefully. So if he is talking about fire and fury such as the world has never seen, you think, well, wow, what has the world never seen? You know, let me think about this really carefully. My goodness, that could be a nuclear war. But what you're saying, Tracy, is that actually this American president is something like a kind of salesman selling you a flashy car. You know, he uses words to just kind of get people excited.
Exactly. And his lack of experience and temperament are really what makes this situation scary.
Is there a sense that every word that he has been issuing is for global consumption, that he is trying to send messages to Asia and to the Chinese government, or does he also sometimes sound as if he is talking to his voters and his supporters in America, and his calculations are sometimes amazingly domestic?
Yeah, I think that's his first priority always, is speaking to his base, keeping those supporters that he still has, he keeps them on board. I think that's always his first audience. That he also gets bang for his buck speaking globally is a bonus.
So, Michael, we mentioned Rex Tillerson speaking to the press on his way back from a trip to Southeast Asia. He visited the Philippines, Thailand, and Malaysia. This is a region that has been used to America being the kind of the big grown-up in the room, the one with the giant navy, the one that's willing to confront China. We're also used to the idea of an American government which, you know, sometimes with a bit of hypocrisy in there, does basically stand for human rights and democracy promotion and doesn't like dictators. And was that America completely on display with this Southeast Asian trip, or was there something quite odd about Rex Tillerson's trip to Southeast Asia this time?
Well, you did some writing that was some beautiful writing on this point, talking about it, and you should mention that in a bit. The fact that the U.S. has sort of returned to a type of realpolitik, I think, in terms of this. When you look at the three countries that are there, they are challenged, to say the least, in terms of human rights, democratic situations, corruption, these types of things. You have a military junta, basically, that's running Thailand. The Tillerson mission was not to admonish them on any of these things. It was about setting up bilateral agreements in terms of trade and other things, because we have clearly displayed a disdain for multilateral agreements. We've pulled out of all of those things, and to rally support for our efforts against North Korea. That's it, and that's all.
So it was very striking, wasn't it, Tracy, that when Rex Tillerson met, for example, President Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines, who in some people's eyes is really leading this very, very violent, you know, extrajudicial killings, a campaign against drug dealers and drug addicts, which involves the police basically just gunning people down, you know, blood-soaked guy. And yet Rex Tillerson basically wanted to talk to him about North Korea and security. Was that the kind of the tone of really this whole Asian tour?
Yes, indeed. Trade and terrorism in North Korea. In the Philippines, you know, all a government has to do is say, oh, we're fighting terrorists, and it seems like this administration will give them a free pass. And that's what Tillerson did with Duterte. They spoke mostly about fighting Islamic State militants mm-hmm. in the southern Philippines. And then at the end, we are told, Tillerson did bring up the drug war, but in strange terms, saying, well, you know, we too are fighting a drug war, and we've spoken to the Mexicans about it, and maybe there are other ways to fight the drug war. But he didn't really criticize.
Presumably in part because his own boss, Donald Trump, said to Rodrigo Duterte in a kind of hello phone call,
you're doing a great job. Exactly. And that has been repeated time and time again. This administration, this president, embraces dictators like Sisi in Egypt and Putin, obviously, and Xi in China, ignoring human rights.
And so, Michael, to kind of cross the globe from Southeast Asia to Latin America, is there a sense of kind of real, there's something quite confusing going on? You have America, which, when it's talking about terrorism or nuclear weapons, President Trump loves a good dictator. He likes a strong man. He likes the iron fist. He's not that fussed about human rights. But then we come to the genuinely awful situation in Venezuela, where there is a government which is very unpopular with a lot of the country, which is essentially repressing the opposition. How does Donald Trump's America wag its finger and say, that looks like a dictatorship, don't do that. In Venezuela, is the double standard kind of up and running? Are we sounding like a traditional American government with Venezuela? What's been going on?
Well, I mean, double standards are nothing new. And yeah, I think this is definitely a double standard. So why is it a double standard and why is it acceptable? I think one is because of the location, the geographic location. It's in our own hemisphere. So it's a very, very real threat that's just south of our border. You have Maduro, who is continuing the philosophy of exporting socialism across South America. So that is worrisome to the U.S. government. I think also there's this interesting situation where you have a Venezuelan government that has nationalized billions of dollars worth of ExxonMobil's assets, which was done while our current Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, was CEO of ExxonMobil.
Tracy, you were based for a long time for the Los Angeles Times in Central America and Latin America. You know the region very well. So we had this very controversial election to create this parallel parliament loyal to the government of President Maduro. Does that mean that everything is going to be calm now? Now he's got what he wanted. He has this parallel parliament. We can calm down and Venezuela is going to be less violent and there'll be fewer protests? So how stable does this feel to you?
Not at all, no. The opposition is going to continue to protest and fight this. We saw the beginnings of a military uprising recently and it was put down quickly, but there will be more and more protests bubbling up and exploding, actually. What they're going to try to do, what Maduro is trying to do with this constituent assembly is to rewrite the constitution and essentially allow himself to stay in power indefinitely. And that is something that most people in Venezuela will protest. So I think it's going to be more and more unstable, more and more violent. And the United States so far has, spoken strongly against what's going on there, has sanctioned quite a few people, including Maduro himself. But beyond that, doesn't seem to have much strategy to deal with it.
And we should not forget that things have not been 100% peachy, to use the technical term, here in Washington, D.C. We have had a remarkable week after, there are a lot of remarkable weeks here in Washington.
We have one after the other.
So let's not forget President Donald Trump, he's a Republican, at least now. I mean, he wasn't always, but he is currently the Republican president sitting in the White House, leading a Republican administration. And the Republicans, as luck would have it, control the Senate and the House of Representatives. So it should all be smooth. It should be smooth sailing. They should be sending bills out to the White House. Donald Trump signs them. Republicans get what they want. It hasn't quite worked like that this week, has it?
No. From Bedminster, from his private club, Donald Trump has excoriated Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell for not being able to get, quote unquote, get anything done. He told Mitch he should get this thing done, get that health care bill done. And he said, I'll even go to the Democrats to get infrastructure done.
And he did this on Twitter. He did this
on Twitter.
Public rebuke of the Senate Majority Leader on Twitter.
And into microphones also. He spoke about him at length. And again, I would say that there's an old term called RINO, which was Republican in name only. And I would say that that really applies to President Trump. He did win as a Republican, but I think he is most proud of beating 16 other Republicans in the primary.
And very briefly, Tracy, you spend a lot of time on Capitol Hill. You know Washington well. The Senate Majority Leader, is that an important job? I mean, if you're a president and you pick a fight with the Senate Majority Leader from your own party, does that tend to end well? Do you get what you want?
Well, you know, the Senate is the body that can impeach the president. And so Trump ought to keep that in mind. I think he's looked at the polls and seen that McConnell is even less popular than he, Trump, is. And so he probably has thought, well, this is a fight I can pick. It should be noted the Republicans initially were willing to kind of put up with anything from Trump because they thought they could get their agenda through. But as that has not happened, as Trump's own ratings have fallen, you see more and more Republicans now willing to speak out.
But it's a bit like a kind of captain on the bridge of a big ship, isn't it? I mean, the Senate is, I mean, I'm sure they're grander than that, but they're a bit like the kind of the engine room. You know, if the captain is saying full speed ahead and the engine room doesn't agree and doesn't want to do anything, he's not going to get anything done if he picks
a
fight.
Right, no, exactly, exactly. You're really cutting your nose to spite your face, as my grandmother would say.
What a remarkable world. Your grandmother's, I think, the most sensible person we've heard from this week, and that is all the time that we have. Thank you so much to Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Michael Williams, CBS Radio news contributor here in Washington. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Thanks for listening.